I forgot my ending. The ending's terribly short. It's just to say that Paul is the real thing, and the heart of the matter is love. That's all I want to say. Right.
At which point I think we'll decree that 2 minutes is up, and I shall come and ask you for questions. I wonder if you had been told that we would begin our first full day together with an hour of solid biblical theology, you would have rejoiced. I think in the event we've been given an absolute treat, and it's been absolutely wonderful. One of the things that nobody has yet said about Father Nick, he made very quick passing reference to having done some work as a translator. That is a bit of an understatement. There is an entire version of the Bible translated by Father Nick, known as the NKV in the trade. And I hope it's in the bookshop. I've read the Gospels out of it, and it's a stunning piece of work, so I commend it to you. Right, difficult questions. Who's got a difficult question?
Paul's, it's better to marry than to burn.
Oh yeah,
people often quote that. But
I knew that would come up. This is 1 Corinthians 7. Now remember, he's writing to the Corinthians, and remember what kind of a city Corinth was. It was a port city, and very much the vices of that city. They had a temple to Aphrodite, according to Plutarch, which, if you wish to, and Aphrodite, remember, is the goddess of sexual love. And if you wished to, if a male wished to express his devotion to that particular goddess, there were 1,000, what we call, priestesses who would assist in expressing this devoted life. So he's writing to a particular situation, and he says in chapter 7, I want you all to remain as I am. And a lot of people have read that meaning celibate, but I suspect it might simply be, look, I don't have to go to a prostitute because my wife is absent. I think that may be what's going on, because at the beginning of chapter 9, he says, 9:1, am I not permitted to take a Christian wife round like Peter and the others? And that's not a very good argument if the Corinthians would have been able to say to him, but Paul, you don't actually have a wife. So I suspect he might have had a wife and that she lived up in Philippi. I can't prove it. So when it sounds as though he's against sex, I don't think he is, but there was clearly a movement in Corinth that was rather against any kind of sexual expression, and Paul actually resists that in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, and that's what's going on there. See, the problem is you've always got to think these letters are occasional. What is the particular occasion that he's dealing with? And it's always a situation of which we only have the half. It's like listening to one side of a telephone conversation. Sorry, that was much too long an answer.
Thank you, Nick. I was really stimulated by that. You say the heart of what Paul's writing is love. Mm. And yet, to me, he comes across as very harsh, as you said, prickly. Mm-hmm. That's a very uncompromising, hard kind of love.
Sure. Can you give an example? Well, could you give an example of what you're thinking of?
Well, I'm thinking of the row he had with Barnabas, for example, right, over John Mark,
sure,
and some of the things you've quoted that he said to the churches.
Mm-hmm. Right, let's separate those two. The row with Barnabas is in Acts, where is it, round about 17 or 18, I think. And that's because Barnabas wanted John Mark, who seems to have been Paul's nephew, to come with them, but John Mark had let them down at a key moment. And Paul, yeah, he's a bit unforgiving. But interestingly, in 1 Corinthians, Barnabas is mentioned very warmly, so they must have put themselves back together. If only we knew a bit more about it, it's true. And you're right, he is prickly. Let me give you a piece of advice. You know, chapter 9 begins with 3 rhetorical questions of 1 Corinthians. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Christ the Lord? When you meet Paul and he asks you those 3 questions, will you please reply yes to all 3? Because he won't like anything else. So, yeah, he does get cross. There's no doubt about it. But he gets cross because he loves Jesus, and he doesn't want people to mis-see Jesus. And he doesn't want people to do contemptuous things like dismissing the house of Stephanus, you know, in 1 Corinthians 16. So I think many of us can be prickly, and Paul is prickly, and possibly you should say, well, we shouldn't be, but he's prickly for quite good reasons at times. Yeah. There's one here.
Thank you. Given everything that you've been talking about Paul's uncompromising dismissal of the law as necessary for Jews, etc., why did he take a vow in Kenchrea?
Yeah, well, it says because of a vow, doesn't it? And that's, I've gone blank for the moment. Is it, where does he mention that? Is it in, it's in Galatians, isn't it? Or, no, it can't be. Anyway, you might get some illumination from the advice they get when they come to Jerusalem in Acts 20, when James, who's kind of running the Jerusalem church, says, look, a lot of people who know that you've been preaching to the Gentiles, and what we want you to do, we've got four people who've taken a vow, we want you to take them into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, just to show that you're on the right side. And that, in fact, turns out to be a bad decision, because it leads to the arrest of Paul, because they think he's brought Gentiles into the court of Israel. So what you've got there is Paul trying to do the right thing. So in 1 Corinthians he says, I make myself all things to all people. To the Jews I'm a Jew, to Gentiles I'm a Gentile. So he gets very cross with Peter, who's quite happy to eat with Gentiles, but when the people come from Jerusalem and say you shouldn't be doing it, Peter gets back, shrinks back. So he wants them to be consistent in the love of Jesus, which gives freedom from the law. Sorry, it's a very complicated answer. Did it make any sense at all?
I'd like to pursue that a bit more later.
All right, yeah. Why don't you pursue it now then? There's no immediate... Because I don't think I was terribly clear in my response. Would you like just to repeat the... Or would you just pursue?
Thank you. If what Paul is saying is that we have freedom in Christ...
Yeah.
Why does he then go along with taking the vow, which puts him back into that kind of Jewish observance?
Yeah, I think that's an extremely good question. Because he no longer regards that as slavery, he's voluntarily doing it. At Easter, I heard a wonderful account of the Orkney poet Edwin Mackay, and there's a poem of his called When the Horses Came. And he talks there about the proud servitude of the horses, who some of you know, I think I can see you nodding, you know that poem. And the horses give themselves freely to human beings to serve as slaves. And I think if you see something like that as going on, Paul doing that, I think actually this Pope Francis, who's taken us all by storm, there's something of that in him. So he doesn't come in with an agenda. I've just been reading this morning his Amoris Laetitia, The Joy of Love. And what he's done is not come in with an agenda, but be at the service of the church and listening to every bit of the church's thought on family life and love in the family. And that's not a bad model, and I think that's what's going on with Paul. Does that make sense? Good.
I was hoping somebody else would ask this question.
Just keep the microphone near to your mouth.
I was hoping somebody else would ask this question, yeah. But they haven't. Paul's apparent view of homosexuality is currently tearing my family apart,
right.
So I'd like to know your views.
Yeah. That you really only get that in chapter 1 of Romans. And it's a casual throwaway line that huge amounts have been built on. But the fact is that Paul... If we were to sit down with Paul today and say, now look, Paul, we know what you didn't know, that there are some people who are born homosexual. I think Paul, like most people, most of his Jewish contemporaries, would see that as pagan self-indulgence, not an expression of love. If you could sit down with Paul and say, well, we've learned that people of the same sex can live together in love, and you're always banging on about love, Paul, I think he might say, well, that's a different story. And actually in chapter 1 of Romans there, it's almost presented as a punishment for the Gentiles having failed to recognize the God who is around them. They indulge in love with each other. He's obviously very displeased about it, but it doesn't justify the kind of persecution of homosexuals that the church has over the centuries gone in for. But I think we're still learning our way around homosexuality. Yeah. Does that help, that answer? Good.
Any others?
You explained earlier that most of what Paul wrote in his letters was for a particular situation.
Mm.
How did that apply to what he said? I think it was to Timothy about how women should or shouldn't take part in worship in the church.
Yeah, well, there's stuff to Timothy. Now, it must be said that not all scholars would agree that the pastoral letters are written by Paul, but let's assume he did write them. And then you've got that stuff in 1 Corinthians 14, haven't you? I do not allow women to talk in church. Let them ask their husbands at home. You've got to say it's occasional. There's something been going on in the church in Corinth that we cannot reconstruct. I mean, it might simply have been that they were bellowing, "What did he say? I didn't hear him. Did you hear what he said?" And he said, "Look, I don't want chaos in church. Our God is a God of peace, not of confusion," he says in that same chapter. And it may be something as simple as that. But it's been built up by men into saying, therefore, women cannot have any authority in the church. And I think Paul would be rather, he would be rather surprised to find that we were reading it in Derbyshire in 2016. He's never heard of Derbyshire, I regret to say. And 2016 he didn't think would come, because he thought the parousia might be my Wednesday of next week at the latest. So I think he would be really astonished if we built that up into a disempowering of women. Oh, yes, sorry. And then the next question is, what about chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians with the women covering their heads? I remember when I was a child and we would go on holiday, they hadn't invented motorways, so you had to stop in a town. And what we would always do is go into the Catholic church and say a prayer. And then if we'd been behaving, we'd be given a nice lolly to reward us. And if my mother or my sister had forgotten to bring their veils, we would lend them our grubby handkerchiefs. And that was because of 1 Corinthians 11. And actually, it's because of a particular translation by Jerome of 1 Corinthians 11, because Paul wants women to have exousia, is the Greek word. That means authority over their heads. And I think there might be reasons for that. Jerome translate that into Latin as velum, presumably because he had no idea what Paul was talking about. He wanted, so it's a veil over their heads. But notice in that passage that Paul says quite clearly it's a disgrace for a man to pray or prophesy with his head covered, and for a woman to pray or prophesy with the head uncovered. And do you see what that means? It means that as far as he's concerned, men and women have equal liturgical functions. That's not often noticed, but I think it's clear. So you're quite right to ask that one. And just one other thing. One of the dangers that the Greeks knew about religion was that of enthusiasm, people getting carried away. And there's the Euripides' play, The Bacchae, which ends up with the king of Corinth being executed by his own mother and carrying the head on a dish like John the Baptist. And you can see that you don't want that sort of thing. And it might be that that's what he's talking about. Yep.
Last one.
Yeah, the bit at the end of 1 Timothy 2, mm-hmm. Which I find difficult, that Eve was the one that was deceived, not Adam, and that women can only be saved through childbearing.
That's one of these difficult passages. He's desperately seeking for arguments there, as he is in the 1 Corinthians 11. Can I just read the 1 Corinthians, because I think it's quite relevant. He gives rather more arguments there, and then I promise to stop gibbering. 1. So this is about what you're to wear in church. And first of all, he starts with a kind of natural law argument. I want you to know that of every man, Christ is the head. Okay, that's all right. And the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. So you've got a nice, neat, descending line. And you could see how that argument might work. Every man, this is the bit I was quoting just now, who prays and prophesies with something on his head, shames his head. And every woman who prays or prophesies, so they can pray and prophesy, shames her head. Because it's one and the same as though she were shorn. Well, is it? It's an argument from the local culture, I take it. Because we do have tombs in Corinth where women are painted with sculpted with rather impressive-looking snoods on their head, and rather dignified. And it may be just a lack of dignity that he's heard about, that he's worried about. For if a woman is covered, let her be shamed. But if it's base for a woman to be shorn, then let her be covered. And then you've got the man ought not to cover his head because he's the glory of God. And he may not feel the argument's all that strong. And the woman is the glory of the man. That's an uncomfortable argument for us today, because it wasn't the man from the woman, but the woman from the man. For the man was not created on account of the woman, but the woman on account of the man. So there, that's an assertion of the inferiority. Therefore, the woman must have, and here you get the word authority, exousia, on her head. And then he gives another argument, because of the angels. What? Well, two possibilities there. There's Genesis 6, where the sons of the gods fell in love with the daughters of the women, and all sorts of unpleasant consequences, including the flood. But, and then he remembers that men and women are equal, because he said that back in Galatians. But there's no such thing as a woman without a man, nor a man without a woman in the Lord. Because as the woman is from the man, so the man is through the woman. So do you see equality and complementarity, which I know is not a fashionable term? Judge among yourselves. Is it fit? So he's asking them to do it. Is it fitting for a woman to pray to God with head uncovered? Well, we would say yes, it's fine. We don't see a problem. Now, doesn't nature teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? I'm just looking around to see. And if a woman has long hair, it's her glory, because the long hair is given to her as a chastity belt. And then the final argument, he reckons, I think, that none of these arguments are going to work. If anyone wants to pick a fight, we do not have this custom, neither do the churches of God. Good night, thank you very much. So I think that's the argument.